Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to catch you up on the latest and the greatest in the world of the automobile. Well, I'm actually in Talladega, Alabama, getting ready to watch the NASCAR race at the Talladega Super Speedway. Should be a great time. Doing my show in advance, so I don't have any results for you, but we'll catch you up on that when I get back to Arizona. And then the following weekend, I'm going to be at Barber Motorsports Park watching the IndyCar race. So a big motorsports travel for Jeff, and look forward to catching you up on all the adventures, as well as the road trip part of the car show. I'm driving across the country and doing some camping as well, so I'll have some stories about that when I return. So right now we're going to talk about that. I got a story about the Long Beach Grand Prix. That's coming up this weekend as well. Of course, we'll have gas prices, and of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. So last year at Indianapolis, I was talking to a gentleman, and he said, "Have you ever been to the Talladega Super Speedway?" And I said, "You know, I haven't." He said, "You know what's interesting is they do back-to-back weekends in Alabama, and that's in NASCAR as well as IndyCar." So NASCAR race is actually today, and then the following weekend, the 28th, the IndyCar race is. So we'll be talking about that next week's show. But right now we're talking about Talladega. Well, the Talladega Super Speedway is located in East Central Alabama. It's the largest track in the NASCAR series, typically produces the fastest race speeds in NASCAR. The track is 2.66 miles in length, making it slightly larger than the 2.5-mile ovals at Daytona as well as Indianapolis. The track is currently home to two of NASCAR's top Sprint Cup Series races, and those two races, one in the spring and one in the fall. The grandstand seat approximately 143,000. But the attendances for the cup races, anywhere from 150 to 170,000, because fans are allowed to watch from the track's infield. Now, NASCAR founder Bill France Sr. helped create the track in the late 60s. At the time, most of NASCAR facilities were located along the Atlantic coast. France wanted a track that was more centrally located in the southeast. He chose a 2,000-acre site just off of Interstate 20, approximately 40 miles east of Birmingham, near the town of Talladega, on an abandoned airfield. Now, France envisioned a track that was, well, longer, wider, and had greater banking than the turns at Daytona International Speedway, which had been designed to be the fastest track in NASCAR. The banking at Talladega is 33 degrees in comparison to 31 degrees, so slightly steeper, and the backstretch is 4,000 feet long. The 4,300 curving front stretch creates a slight fifth turn in front of the main grandstand. That's why the track is called a tri-oval. Now, the track construction began on May 23, 1968, and the facility opened the following year as Alabama International Motor Speedway. Adopted the name Talladega Super Speedway in 1989. Now, the first race at the track was the Bama 400, and that was held September 13th, 1969. And that was a part of NASCAR's second-tier Grand Touring Circuit. And Ken Rush won the inaugural event there. And then the first Grand National race, called the Talladega 500, was held the next day. And that was won by Richard Brickhouse, taking the checkered flag just seconds ahead of runner-up Jim Vandiver. Now, the inaugural race almost didn't happen because many of NASCAR's top drivers did not want to participate. Observing that cars were reaching nearly 200 miles an hour in practice and qualifying, the drivers were concerned that the tires would not be able to handle such speed for the entire 500-mile race. These concerns prompted the Professional Drivers Association, led by Richard Petty, to call for a boycott of the race. Rather than cancel the race at the last minute, France decided to proceed with the drivers who did not participate in the boycott. The full 500 miles were completed without any major incident in front of a crowd of approximately 62,000 people. Now, the track quickly became accepted by drivers and fans alike. Two NASCAR race weekends were scheduled in 1970, and the track has held a twice-a-year events hosted by NASCAR since. The first Talladega race of 1970, the Alabama 500, was also the first stock car race ever televised under the new agreement between NASCAR and ABC. Now, in 1971, the same race was sponsored by the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company and was renamed the Winston 500. The sponsorship allowed Talladega to offer a total of $100,000 in prize money, which at the time was the largest in NASCAR history. Now, in addition to NASCAR's premier series, known as at this time known as Winston Cup, brothers Donnie and Bobby Allison, both natives of the Birmingham suburb of Hueytown and a part of what has been known as NASCAR's Alabama Gang, finished first and second in the inaugural Winston 500. 46 lead changes in the race made it one of the greatest in NASCAR's history at that point, and the track's second race continued to be known as the Talladega 500 before picking up a corporate sponsor with Sears Diehard Batteries in 1988. Now, races at Talladega began and continued to become faster and have closer finishes throughout the 70s and the 80s, and consistently became more dangerous. The track's first fatality occurred in 1973 in the Talladega 500 when Larry Smith, the 1972 Winston Cup Rookie of the Year, died when his car hit the outside concrete wall in the first turn on lap 14. The only other death at the track during a NASCAR sanctioned event was the 1975 Talladega 500 when Dwayne Tiny Lund died when his car spun on the sixth lap and then was hit by the side of Terry Link's car. Four drivers have also passed away in the ARCA series between 82 and 91. Now, Talladega's reputation for producing some of the most exciting racing in NASCAR firmly established in the 70s when the margin of victory for the winners began to measure in routinely in tenths of seconds. 1981 Talladega 500 produced one of the closest finishes in NASCAR history when Ron Bouchard, Darrell Waltrip, and Terry Labonte crossed the finish line together, Bouchard outpacing Waltrip for the victory by just 2 feet. Talladega reached the peak of its competitiveness in 1984 at the Winston 500. 75 changes for the lead established a record that actually stood until 2010. Now, the track has hosted other NASCAR milestones. On April 29, 1982, Benny Parsons became the first driver to exceed 200 miles an hour in qualifying, clocking in with an average lap speed of 200.176, and for several years, qualifying itself became a major event at Talladega as they attempted to break another speed record. Cale Yarborough ran 202.6, and then Bill Elliott shattered the record, qualifying speed of 209.3, 212.2 in 1986, and 212.8 in 1987. All 43 cars for the field of the 1987 Winston 500 qualified at a speed of more than 200 miles an hour, and there was actually some talk of cars possibly reaching 220 miles an hour. Now, all of that changed in May 3rd, 1987, when Bobby Allison lost control of his car during the race when he blew a tire. The rear end of the car spun around, and the car became airborne and slamming into the catch fence that separates the track from the grandstands. The impact wiped out a 35-yard section of the fence, but fortunately the car bounced back onto the track and no major injuries occurred with the fans in the grandstands. Now, Allison suffered only minor injuries as well, but still the image of an out of control car careening through the crowd horrified NASCAR officials, and it was quickly decided that the ever-escalating speeds had to be reduced. Now, when the circuit returned later that year for the Talladega 500, the cars were equipped with smaller carburetors, reducing the engine horsepower and speed. Top qualifying speed was 203.8, which was 9 miles an hour slower than Elliott's record pace in May. In 1988, the carburetor restrictor plates were introduced for both Talladega and Daytona. Over the years, NASCAR has tweaked the sizes of the holes in the plate, cutting back on the air that reaches the engine, further reducing the horsepower. By 2001, top speeds has dropped as slow as 185, but since then they've increased to about 190 or so. Now, in addition to slowing the cars, the restrictor plates also forced the competitors to drive approximately the same speed. As a result, Talladega became known as the track that produced the thrilling races, with 30 or 40 cars could be packed together quite tightly, circling the track 2 and 3 wide. Most of the drivers, well, they hated it because it was very difficult to avoid if there were any trouble, if there was a crash. Now, because the cars raced in such of a tight pack, the slightest contact between two cars could start a big chain reaction, which could take out 10 to even 20 cars. These spectacular multi-car accidents are dubbed the big one. For better or for worse, it became a staple of the racing at Talladega. The style of racing was extremely popular with the fans, and the crowd sizes have surged to more than 150,000 for most races. Now, one driver who mastered the art of restrictor plate racing at Talladega was Dale Earnhardt Sr. In his 27 Winston Cup races at the track following Allison's accident, Earnhardt finished in the top five 17 times, including 8 victories. He also finished his career with 10 victories at Talladega, the most in track history. And after Earnhardt's death in 2001, his son took over as the dominant driver at Talladega. Dale Earnhardt Jr. won 5 Winston Cup races at the track from October 1st to October 04, including a record 4 in a row. The only other driver other than the Earnhardts that have more than 4 career wins is Jeff Gordon, who has won 6 times between 1996 and 2007. Well, after the April race in 2006, Talladega Super Speedway began a massive repaving of the track, first time in 26 years. When the drivers returned in October, they gave the new racing service rave reviews and participants in the race. There were 63 lead changes. Now, while races are what mostly takes place at the track, the facility is used year-round. One program allows fans to ride and drive around the track. Automakers use the track to test cars for both speed and endurance. Television commercials have been filmed there. And there was also a racing movie called Talladega Nights that was filmed there as well. Alabama State Troopers and other law enforcement personnel use the track to train recruits on high-speed pursuit and defensive driving techniques, but Talladega primarily was built specifically to produce the fastest and most exciting racing in NASCAR. And more than 40 years after its creation, it's still doing exactly that. And folks, I can't tell you how excited I am to go to this race. And I will have more information and some stories for you when I get back in a couple weeks. We'll talk a little news from NASCAR. The headline reads, Elliott pays tribute to Alan Kulwicki, ends his dry spell with a win in Texas. Well, Sunday's race at Texas Motor Speedway brought to life an image that hasn't been seen at the NASCAR Cup Series for a long time. The Hooters car returning to the checkered flag and driving backwards to celebrate the win. Not only did Chase Elliott finally break his winless streak that has lasted more than a year, he celebrated the occasion with the Hooters colors on his Hendrick Motorsport Chevrolet Camaro by doing the Polish victory lap. Harkening back to 1992 Cup champion Alan Kulwicki and his famous number 7 Ford Thunderbird. Needless to say, Elliott came into Sunday's Auto Trader Echo Park 400 at Texas Motor Speedway with a lot riding on his shoulders. Incident after incident at the end of the race necessitated an extra 14 miles of overtime, and that pressure had to carry on. Quote, Hooters has been a partner of ours for a number of years now, Elliott said on the front stretch after his win. It's been a dream of mine to pay back the respect of the late Alan Kulwicki and his driving his car to victory and then doing the Polish victory lap. It's really crazy how things have come full circle, and it's pretty emotional for me. Well, Alan Kulwicki was a longtime Cup Series rival of his father, Bill Elliott, which is Chase's dad. So to be able to carry the same colors to victory once again that brought so much extra gravitas, not also to say the helping bring the victory back of Elliott's for Hendrick Motorsports and his crew. Kulwicki beat dad back in the day, so sharing this with our sponsor is having an opportunity to win today. Man, I couldn't be more grateful for this journey. The path hasn't always been fun, but we've worked really hard together, and we've been working really hard, and we've been having fun, but it hasn't been as much fun, but we've really enjoyed the fight. So, pretty cool. Driving the Hooters car, Mr. Chase Elliott gets a win, and it's been over a year, and he had a difficult time last year. He had a snowboarding accident, which put him out for multiple races, and then he got suspended for rough driving later on that year. So last year was pretty tough for Chase Elliott, but back in victory lane after winning the Auto Trader Echo Park 400 last weekend down at Texas Motor Speedway. Formula One news, and the headline reads, Andretti officially opens Formula One facility at Silverstone. Well, Global Andretti has officially opened its Formula One facility at Silverstone as it continues for its preparations for a potential entry into Formula One in 2026. Now, the 48,000-square-foot facility is based at Silverstone Park Technology and Business Park, the home of the British Grand Prix, and has a current workforce of 80 people building and designing and developing the car that could race in 2026. The new building was officially opened by Michael and Mario Andretti of Andretti Global. At present, Andretti is working on a chassis for the current regulations as it develops its facilities, with the Silverstone base and housing manufacturing facility, including patterns, molds, street machines, machine shops, AMD, etc. And the Silverstone factory will work alongside with the main site in Indiana and the organization's Formula One e-base in Bainbury. Well, we have a lot of work to do when we continue at pace with this new facility, says Michael Andretti. We plan to have an all-American team and cars assembled in the U.S. and have a European base is a great way to attract some of the best Formula One talent in the world. Andretti says the Silverstone facility will be completed in phases according to the commercial and the sporting needs and the workforce. With Andretti Formula One team yet to secure a Formula One entry, they rejected their entry for the 2025, but it's possible that they could run into 2028 when General Motors has stated its intention to produce an F1 power plant. So Michael Andretti continues to push forward, even though Formula One said not so fast. Michael said, no, we are. We're going to continue to move on. So I wish him a lot of luck, and hopefully he can get this done and have another American team in Formula One. Well, normally I'm in Los Angeles this weekend for the Long Beach Grand Prix, but as I said, I'm in Talladega watching NASCAR run. But nonetheless, they are running this weekend in Long Beach for the Long Beach Grand Prix, Southern California's 200-mile-an-hour beach party. So when I get back, I will give you all the results from that, and hopefully I will be back at Long Beach next year. Well, from the pages of Hemmings, this one's called Seller's Remorse. Well, not with these cars, and this is from David LaChance, one of their writers. Well, sometimes it gets pretty cold where I live. Cold enough to make a true crisis, like running low on coffee, or maybe tortilla chips. How could I leave the house? Well, maybe I can't. In situations like this, I might have to go on foot. But the good news is I've got the reliability of a modern car. Just twist the key or push the button, and it always, mostly, goes. That hasn't always been the case. I have a particularly vivid memory of a winter night many, many years ago when I was a cub reporter working the late shift in the bureau of a Metropolitan Daily newspaper. I trudged out to the parking lot, put the key in the ignition of my Volkswagen Squareback, and cranked it until the battery pretty much died. That's when it was followed by a misguided attempt to walk 12 miles to my apartment, like some modern-day Ernest Shackleford or Shackleton trying to get to the South Pole. Well, unfortunately, but unlike Shackleton, I was able to call a taxi from a payphone at a donut shop about halfway through my trek. Now, of course, I got a ride back to the office the next morning. Guess what? The VW started right up. The weather had turned mild, and I guess, well, there'd gotten some ice in the fuel line that stranded me. And I'll take some of the blame. I think the tank wasn't full, and because I really couldn't afford to fill the tank all the way. So you get a little moisture build up, and next thing you know, you've got a frozen gas line. But honestly, I believe that Squareback had been plotting to freeze me to death. Between the inoperative heater and the strategically placed rust holes that allowed the Arctic air to flow through the cabin. Now, that spring, I brought that Volkswagen to a local used car dealer, and I drove off in a used Honda Civic hatchback, which remains one of the best automotive transactions I have made to date. Now, lots of us have stories of beloved cars we wish we had never sold. And I have some of those stories too. But sometimes I'd also like to recognize sometimes what's just a bad fit. Sometimes some of those happiest memories are that particular car that's now in the taillights of my existence. Let's talk about an AMC Hornet Sportabout, which I owned when I was in college, and it falls into this category. It seemed like a nice enough fit at first. Good with, we had a good heater and plenty of room to cart my stuff home and to the dorm and back every year. And it had a big, 258 cubic inch six cylinder. The little wagon had a hard time climbing up some of those big hills. I soon discovered that the front fenders tops were mostly Bondo, and they were rusted out and they were crumbling like the not very tasty taco. And one of the spring seats, well, it broke and came adrift, poking out of the cushion like a Tex Avery cartoon come to life. But a buyer miraculously appeared, and I signed away the titles No Regret, aware that, well, I think my life had just gotten a little better. Now, sometimes I had learned that this equation works in the opposite direction, and it's the car that needs to be freed from me. And that was the case with the Triumph Spitfire. Now, I am a frugal enthusiast, and I've always been drawn to interesting cars with mechanical needs, and that's exactly what the Spitfire was. The seller said it was running rich, and turned out to be that was an understatement. Well, what was coming out of the tailpipe could have peeled paint. I made a deal and brought the car home, figuring out that, well, that repair shouldn't be too complicated, and it wasn't. All it needed was a new needle for the Stromberg carburetor. But over the years, that Spitfire, well, it drove me a little crazy. I installed an interior kit, replaced the universal joints in the drivetrain, added an overdrive transmission, and a pair of UK-spec SU's carburetors. I soon learned how to apply wood veneer, redid the dash, a very satisfying job, by the way. All the while, the rust was literally chewing away at the body. First went the rear wheel arches, followed by the sills, followed by the floor plans. I daydreamed about my repair schemes, and I made a list and panels and spent countless hours thinking about what color I would choose to replace its current red paint job. Well, all that came to nothing. After letting the car sit far too long, I finally offered it for sale. And, well, I was contacted by a friend who wanted a project for his grandson. And watching his trailer pull away with the Spitfire on board, I could feel things had turned out for the best. The Triumph would get a new life with an enthusiastic owner that could go on, get some of those expectations, and I could reclaim some acres of mental space now that that roadster has gone. Sometimes what they say about a boat ownership kind of goes for cars too. The two happiest days are the day you buy it and the day you sell it. And I have several of those cars in my history as well, but not enough time to talk about those today. Well, let's talk some gas prices with our friends at AAA. Right now, the average gas price is $3.63. A week ago, it was $3.59. A month ago, $3.41. And 1 year ago, it was $3.66. So as much as I'm squirming about these gas prices, according to this, they're fairly consistent. As I mentioned, I'll look forward to telling you all about my gas price stories as I traverse across the United States from Arizona to Florida, Alabama, and parts in between, and let you know what kind of gas prices I was able to get. All right, let's see what's going on with our gas prices here in Arizona. Well, pretty consistent. Average gas price right now is $4.14. A week ago, it was $3.99. A month ago, it was $3.65. And a year ago, well, it was $4.50 a gallon. So it's at least not there yet, but it's coming quick, it seems like. Right now, the least expensive gas in the state. How about the Love's Travel Stop in Prescott? For gas at $3.19. Speedy Truck Stop in Lupton at $3.22. In Eloy, the TA Travel Center at $3.38. And if you're in Fort Mojave, well, you can get gas for $3.39 a gallon at the Walmart. And up at near the Grand Canyon Village, the Texaco Station, $5.39 a gallon. All right, let's talk Phoenix gas prices. Wow, average gas price in Phoenix, $4.36 a gallon. A week ago, it was, well, $4.15. And a month ago, it was $3.75. So we've seen quite a bit of escalation. And a year ago, it's not as bad as it was a year ago. We were $4.77 a gallon. Least expensive gas in the city, $3.89 at Costco over on the west side, 33rd Avenue and Grand. The 76 station in South Phoenix at Central Avenue and Sunland at $3.89 at the 76 station. Let's take a look. The Marathon station on Scottsdale Road at Thomas and 68th Street in Scottsdale, $3.90. And the most expensive gas in town, $4.89 at the Shell station in Mesa. Let's take a look at some of the world gas prices. Well, the least expensive gas in the world is in Iran. It's 10 cents a gallon. If you live in Libya, besides all the other problems you got, you can get gas for 11 cents and Venezuela at 13 cents. All right, let's talk some traditional locations, maybe a little more that you might think about. How about this? Russia, $2.25 a gallon. In Ecuador, $2.46. Let's take a look down the line. Taiwan, $3.67 a gallon. Let's take a look. Puerto Rico, $4.11. If you happen to be in Brazil, $4.33. China, $4.54. Happen to be in Nepal, you can get gas for $4.98. And now let's start getting a little bit more expensive. Let's get to, if you're in Poland, $6.41. If you're in United Kingdom, $7.05. Barbados, almost $8 a gallon. Greece, $8.05. And the most expensive gas in the world, that's in Hong Kong, $12.05 a gallon. Wow, that's a lot. Well, we've reached that time. It's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I have a turbo six-cylinder that calls for 93-octane gasoline. I'm not sure I can afford this. If I hocked my stepson and I had the dog run away, I might be able to afford that. On the other hand, if I didn't do all those things, I could use regular gasoline and they could all stay in the house. Can I do this without any negative consequences? Well, it depends, Si. And if you're buying a car that requires 93-octane, you're going to have to spend that extra 25 to 40 cents per gallon to get that extra octane. One of the reasons the engine can produce lots of power for their size is that they compress the air-fuel mixture at such a high pressure. That's why they're called a high-compression engine. The situation is those higher compression engines need fuel that have a higher ignition point. That's why it has a higher octane fuel usage. Now, when they say depends, Si, it's because whether your owner's manual says requires or recommends. If your manufacturer recommends, that means to get the maximum performance in the car, you need to use the high octane fuel. In other words, you don't have to. If it's a situation where they require you, then the engine will not run properly if you don't. So, if it requires 93, you're probably out of luck, and I guess the dog's going to have to find a new home besides the backseat of your BMW. So, the next time you go car shopping, you might want to put the list of things to check, and then you'll have to find out whether you have to choose between a 5 Series BMW and your dog. Yes, and I had a conversation with a friend about this many, many years ago, and in fact, it wasn't a BMW, and I actually got better gas mileage slightly by using the high-octane fuel, but when I looked at the cost effectiveness versus the cheaper fuel, it always worked out better to buy the less expensive fuel, but it's true, the better fuel will make the car perform better if it's recommended. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name's Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.